You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the Southwest Wisconsin Groundwater and Geology Study. SWIG is the acronym that we'll be hearing. The researchers have been working on it for 19 months, and in the current phase, they're tracking down fecal sources of contamination in private wells in three counties, Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette. Do you live in one of these counties? Is your well contaminated? What questions do you have about the study findings to date, to the present? We're at 800-642-1234. Ken Bradbury is a Wisconsin state geologist. He directs the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, which is part of the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. He's on the team working on the SWIG study. Ken, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So you and the team are about halfway through the study of these private wells. What do you know now about the types of contamination that you're seeing in these wells?
Well, we've been looking at mainly two things, nitrate and bacteria. And the latest work we've done is to speciate the kind of bacteria to determine whether it's coming from people or animals, specifically cattle or pigs or people. And so we've started the study with samples of from over 800 private wells in those three counties, just looking at for the presence of bacteria, specifically coliform bacteria, and nitrate levels in the wells. And then we've reported those results before, but a fairly high percentage of the wells had one or both of those things. And then more recently, we've sampled a small subset of those wells that we knew to be contaminated to see what the bacterial source was.
All right. So fairly high percentage having either nitrates and or bacteria. When you say a fairly high percentage, what does that mean?
Well, for example, in November 2018, our first round of sampling, we found that 42% of the wells had either bacterial detections or nitrate above the drinking water standard of 10, which, so 42% is pretty high. When we sampled those large set again in April of 2019, it was a little bit less, it was 27%, but ideally we would have zero. So either of those is a pretty high number. And they're generally higher than other places in Wisconsin. And we know that wasn't a big surprise because that Southwest Wisconsin geology and hydrogeology is a fairly vulnerable landscape with often thin soils and not much attenuation of contamination of contaminants as they move down to bedrock aquifers. So it wasn't a big surprise, but it is a interest, and certainly we're interested in water quality, so we want to know what people are drinking out there.
And so in the smaller subset that you're looking at, where is the contamination coming from? Is it people or animals or both?
It's both, which is very, very interesting. So we found fecal microbes. So these are things that are shed in feces from both humans, cattle, and pigs, and some of these are actually pathogenic, meaning they can make people sick. So it's important to know these things. But the reason we wanted to do this speciation is that people have pointed fingers to saying, well, it's all farmers, or no, it's all septic tanks and so forth. And we're finding it's both, which is not a big surprise, but it shows us that everything we do on the landscape can have some kind of impact.
We're talking with researcher Ken Bradbury. He's been working to identify fecal sources of contamination in private wells in several southwestern Wisconsin counties. He's sharing the latest from the SWIG study with your insights, your questions. Has your well been contaminated? What steps did you take to clean your water source? Have you been in touch with county officials about your private well? What are those conversations like? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ken, why these three counties did you focus the study on?
Well, I should emphasize that these counties came to us. So
they,
the county soil and water departments in each county initiated, and actually the counties have funded this, much of this study. So it was initiated by the counties, but the reason they were interested is that this was a part of the state that had not been studied much before in as far as a comprehensive water quality study. Other parts of the state like Kewaunee County and Door County have had a lot more historical research done. These counties felt that they might have a problem, but it had not been well documented. So this was initiated by the counties, and hats off to them for doing that.
And that's the counties, again, Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette. What
Correct.
Interests you about the geology of these counties?
Well, it's a very interesting geology because it's carbonate rocks mostly, which are rocks like limestone or dolomite, and as you know, the Southwest Wisconsin is what we call the driftless area. So it was not glaciated. That means there's a lot of topography, big hills, deep valleys, a rather old landscape. And because of that, there are places where bedrock is quite near the surface, and there's older soils on top of that that we have not had a chance to understand that well. So this gives us a reason to do research on those. And it's also a place where, as I said before, we had not done a lot of research on groundwater in the past. So it's been a very interesting place to work.
So at what point then are the contaminants leaching into the wells? Where is this breaking down where we see the contamination?
Well, the contamination starts at the ground surface. So this it's important to understand that all of this is starting at something on the ground surface. Nitrate and bacteria are not things that are normally present in pristine groundwater. If we go to places like northern Wisconsin, where, say, up in the Schwabing-Nicolet, where there's very little agriculture or people living, we see very, very low nitrate in groundwater. So seeing high nitrate in bacteria shows us that these are caused by people and things that are happening on the landscape. And the things that happen are agriculture is a big one. We dispose of manure. We do fertilization. We have pasture cattle and pigs, and we have pots and those sorts of things. And then we also have septic tanks and human waste disposal. And the water sources, of course, are private wells, which are simply holes in the ground that are lined with steel pipes and of various depths. And of course, those are the design is prescribed by the DNR, but many of these wells are quite old. Some of them are not in good shape. Some of them are shallow. And so one thing we're doing in this study is looking at the type of well and the well design and how the well, is constructed to see if that correlates to whether or not we're finding some of these contaminants.
Does the age of a well also factor into this? Because you said some of these wells are quite old.
Yeah. Some of them can be, up to 100 years old. And when you think about it, the well is something that's often out of sight, out of mind on a property. It's a very, very important part of a home's infrastructure, you could say, but it's not something that people think a lot about. So wells can, casings can rust, things can happen at the top of the well, it can be damaged. Maybe somebody backs a car into it or someone piles waste next to the well. So there are a lot of pathways that contaminants can get into a well, particularly if it's an old well and hasn't been maintained properly.
Talking with geologist Ken Bradbury about the SWIG study looking into private well contamination in three southwestern Wisconsin counties. Are you living in an area that has had issues with clean water? What questions do you have about the contamination? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a groundwater study here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So researchers, they launched the SWIG study back in September of 2018. It stands for Southwest Wisconsin Groundwater and Geology Study. Now they're in phase two, trying to identify fecal sources of contamination in private wells in Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties. Do you live in one of these counties? Are you concerned about contamination and access to clean drinking water? What questions do you have about private wells for the geologist? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ken Bradbury directs the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, and he's part of the SWIG study team. He stays with us. So, Ken, when a homeowner's well tests positive for contamination, what options do they have with their private well?
Well, that's a great question, Kate. And the first thing that we always recommend is that they inspect the well, make sure that they know where the well is, make sure it's got a good cap on the top of it, and make sure there's no contamination source next to it or nearby, and which could be a pile of waste, runoff from a farm field going right by the well, or runoff from the yard or something like that. The next thing that they might want to do is contact a licensed well driller or pump installer and have them inspect the inside of the well. And it's important that a licensed person, professional, do that and see if there's any, they can detect any problem with the well. And they might even, this professional might even want to chlorinate the well, which may take care of the bacteria problem if it's something to do with the well. Beyond that, then it's the next step would be to look around the landscape and see if there's any other contamination sources nearby. And these things are tricky, and sometimes we can't find the source, and that's a frustrating thing for everybody. Those are some of the steps we take. And if the DNR and UW Extension have a lot of information about wells that can help the homeowner. So I would also suggest contacting the local extension office or contacting the DNR too. They have a lot of fact sheets and information about wells and how to worry about your well, how to take care of your well.
Ken, why
some of the steps?
Yeah, Ken, why is seasonal testing important for checking in on these wells and researching these private wells?
In doing hydrogeologic studies, we always want to do seasonal testing because here in Wisconsin, such the big swings in weather from winter to summer, and so we know that in the spring, like now, we've been getting a lot of rain. And so you get a lot more groundwater recharge happening in the summer when it's in the normal summer anyway. It's hot and dry. We get less recharge. In the fall, we get more recharge again. And then the way that farmers manage their land changes through the season. So they are disposing of or spreading manure and fertilizer in the spring and summer. Crops are growing for part of the year, and they are using these nutrients and the crops. When the crops are not on the field, then the nutrients are not used by crops and can go into groundwater. So we are trying to see if we can correlate these contaminant presence to different times of the year, different practices going on the land. And that's why we sample seasonally.
We're talking with State Geologist Ken Bradbury. He's with us as we look at well contamination in three southwestern Wisconsin counties. You can join in. Are you living in an area of the state that has had issues accessing clean water? What questions do you have about the sources of contamination? And how would you like to see policymakers address the issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Ken, where does your study team go next? What do you work on next with this study?
Well, we're now at the stage, Kate, of doing correlations between the water quality information that we've found with things about the well and about the landscape, such as depth to bedrock, distance type of well, that's depth of a well or the kind of casing a well might have. Things near the well, like number of agricultural fields, number of septic systems, number of feedlots, to determine correlations or relationships between water quality and these things we do on the land surface. Now, of course, correlation is not causation, but it is important to understand the if come up with a way we can try to predict the risk of contamination from various practices. Now, this procedure follows the same kind of procedure that has been done in Kewaunee County, and it was very, really successful up there in showing, for example, that areas with shallow bedrock had a much more were much more likely to get contamination.
Yeah.
And so those sorts of things are important to know, and then we can find those things, and then it might be possible to develop some new guidelines for landscape management or well design and that kind of thing.
Quite a bit of detective work going on there. Let's bring in a call now. Mark is with us from Iowa County. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you. I was wondering about pesticide contamination also. Perhaps metabolites can show up. I know nitrate goes with fertilizer and the bacteria, of course. And also, it seems like the long-term solution would be for local codes, not one code for all the state, but to have solutions for well and septic design for the geology of an area.
So, 2 points there, Mark. Certainly, pesticides are an important concern. It's not something we're sampling for here. The Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection does quite a bit of pesticide sampling, but you're right. Pesticides and metabolites can be an issue. It's just not something that we were able to do in this study. It would be interesting to do that, but we couldn't do everything. As far as you mentioned codes or regulations, it is true that one size doesn't fit all, and we have a very varied geology across Wisconsin. And so I don't know, I'm not on the policy side here, but I think it is important to target any codes or regulations to specific parts of the state. I don't know if it can be as specific as one county, but it can be targeted for regions where we have similar hydrogeology. And I think that makes more sense than trying to have one sort of code that fits everything, because that's so hard to do in a place that like Wisconsin, where we have such a wide variety of hydrogeology and geologic settings.
Mark, thank you. Let's bring in Melody now in Ferryville. Hi, Melody.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just want to comment that a couple of months ago at Crawford County Prairie du Chien Board, I went in there on another subject matter to meet the board. And there was two rows of chairs, one for the hog farmers, one for the people in the community. The crux of the matter is people in the community, because of the well water, was concerned that the hog farmer wanted to enhance his farm by 1,000 pigs. Although he would not be adding more land to it, I felt bad for the pigs. Nevertheless, the people were concerned about their water with the phosphorus. And I was not there. I did not know. It was sad because the front row of chairs were left for the hog farmers, the back row for the community. So even though there was 5-6 chairs empty for the hog farmers, at first they let 80-year-old people sit and wait from the community.
Melody, thank you. Thank you for that call. In these CAFOs situations as well, Ken, that is a concern when you have these confined animal feeding operations and animals close together.
Yes, it is, and that's one of the things when I mentioned we were looking at correlations for different activities. Looking at these locations of these CAFOs is something that we are looking at, and she mentioned hogs specifically. And I mentioned that we are looking at the different sorts of bacteria and fecal bacteria that are found in wells, and indeed we have found some from hogs. We've also found some from cattle and some from people. So it's not hogs alone. We know that, but hogs are part of the issue.
So as we look forward here, southwestern Wisconsin has a relatively high percentage of contamination in private wells. Hotspots like Kewaunee County have kind of figured out culprits. What can homeowners do?
Well, homeowners need to be aware of their water source, and they need to test it. We recommend testing at least once a year for nitrate and bacteria. And one message that I like to give to people is that if you are on a private well, you are in charge of that well, meaning that nobody's coming to test it for you or check it out. And I think a lot of homeowners, particularly new rural homeowners, don't really understand that there's no the city water department or the county is not going to come and inspect your well for you. That's something you have to do yourself. And water quality can change with time. So just because you had a clean well at one time when the house was built or something doesn't mean that it's always going to be that way. And it's important to check it, because these can have an effect on your health, particularly if there's high nitrate or a pathogenic bacteria that can affect you. And so it's important for people to test their own well. And that's something that's not expensive and fairly easy to do.
Ken, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Ken Bradbury, Wisconsin State geologist, talking about the SWIG study. Coming up, we talk with the physicians on the front line of the coronavirus. That's after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a signpost here, as the impact of COVID-19 grows, WPR continues to bring you coverage of news as it happens from our reporters stationed around the state. We've centralized our coronavirus content. It's all at WPR.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about COVID-19 symptoms and treatment. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it added 6 symptoms this week to its coronavirus list. New to the CDC's list are chills, repeated shaking with chills, muscle pain, headache, sore throat, and new loss of taste or smell. And these have been added to the original list that had 3 symptoms: shortness of breath, cough, and fever. Have you recovered from COVID-19? Are you battling it right now? What are your symptoms and treatment like? Healthcare teams, are you treating patients in your hospital? What can you tell us about what you're facing? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Joseph Padaruca is chair of the intensive care unit in the Department of Pediatrics at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also the principal investigator for the Convalescent Plasma Expanded Access Program at the Mayo Clinic in southwest Wisconsin. Dr. Padaruca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
What is the situation like at your hospital right now? What are you seeing?
You know, what we're seeing is really an effect of some early intervention by our governor to flatten the curve with the stay-at-home order. We had planned to ramp up, including a tiered surge plan for our hospital, harnessing and leveraging all of our resources. But fortunately, we haven't seen the big wave such that you're seeing in New York, Washington. But we've been able to use those lessons we've learned from those other hospitals to provide optimal care and also to come up with ways to treat our patients.
What are some of those lessons learned that you're finding from your colleagues in other states and other parts of the world?
Some of those have to do with clinical management, and some of those have to do with how we take care of our patients and staff and protect them. Some of the unique interventions that have been and lessons taught involve how we provide ventilation for these patients and also how we manage other medical complications that evolve. So these patients who get very sick, they may require paralysis to give them optimal ventilation and lung recovery. They also, we've noticed that they develop clots that can lead to strokes or clots in the lungs, and we've been prompted to use some blood thinning medications to prevent that. As far as patients, family, visitors, we've ramped up how we look at using personal protective equipment to keep our hospital staff safe and also to avoid transmission in the community.
Do you find that you have enough gloves, enough masks, enough shields?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. You know, that PPE, as we call it, that protective equipment, is a very limited resource, and it's been leveraged to hot spots in the country. We've come up with conservation efforts to preserve that and also recycle that in some cases for repurposing. Also key to preserving PPE is the use of virtual technology. So we have video cameras in the rooms, iPads and tablets. We've done some unique things like bring, for the sickest patients, bringing their pumps and their ventilators outside the room to limit that need for healthcare workers to go in the room and waste that valuable resource.
So I can probably see you're stringing a lot of things across and out in a hallway to get access to equipment so you're not having to go inside the room itself.
Exactly. And that's a protective measure not only for our staff, but also, again, to preserve those resources.
We're talking with Dr. Joe Padaruca, who chairs the intensive care unit at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also the assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics in the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science, taking your questions about treatment and about symptoms of COVID-19. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Padaruca, it seems like the American public has been very much up in your business about the treatment protocols that are emerging with these very ill patients. You know, there was so much talk about ventilators at first as being these life-saving devices for these patients. Now there's been more of this trend of less invasive and maybe less risky therapies. What is your take on ventilators as it stands now?
Yeah, I think it's evolved how we look at that resource. We understand that patients, if you let them go too long, they can damage their lungs just by the effort of their breathing and by delaying and leading to other medical problems in their body system. So we have looked to possibly ramp up our support for the respiratory tract. One method is flipping them on their stomach while they're awake to provide oxygenation. We also, in some select cases, if we know it's very severe, we'll try for an early intubation, meaning putting the breathing tube in the throat, putting them on the ventilator. The idea is that we allow their lungs time to heal because we're capturing that severe illness up front and allow them to be liberated from the ventilator much more easily. We've also had some novel therapies come through. You may have heard in the news that remdesivir, that medication targeting the virus production. And this is actually pretty huge. We've seen, as the early studies show in this phase 3 trial, clinical trial, a 31%, one-third improvement in the day towards resolution of symptoms, and then a trend towards reduction in mortality from 12 to 8%. If the study had been powered, meaning more numbers of patients, that would have been a significant result. We also have that plasma, so the plasma from recovered victims. Again, this being sort of a novel virus, we didn't have a lot of medications. The body had not seen it before in the human species. So getting the recovered antibodies from another recovered person and having this available through our health system as an option has been very intriguing. We used this in that SARS in 2013. It showed some benefit. So we have consented some patients here, and I know some patients in Wisconsin have received this recovered donor plasma.
We're going to talk more about convalescent plasma in a moment. Going back to remdesivir for a moment, was this originally designed to treat Ebola disease? And are researchers looking to other disease treatment methods to try to inform how they go about, you know, trying to find something that will work against COVID-19?
Yeah. So drugs like this have been used for viral processes, including Ebola. And it really has to do with the mechanism of action, how the drug works. It really targets how the virus replicates itself using RNA. And trying to come up with novel therapies to something we really haven't dealt with before, these clinical trials have evolved. Remdesivir being one of the first ones. We've also looked at the use of some of those other medications like hydroxychloroquine. However, those results have not been very promising, with many trials cut short due to the heart arrhythmia risk factors that can potentially lead to early death or bad arrhythmias in patients.
And as a cardiologist, I'm sure that really concerns you as well.
Yeah, a lot of these drugs that we use, unfortunately, for viruses are on the the hit list, if you will, the long QT hit list. That's one of the intervals in the cardiac cycle. And they can cause problems, including lethal arrhythmias like ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia. And it's really hard to screen these patients up front. There's also a lot of drug-drug interactions that could potentiate these bad heart rhythms. They also have some other side effects that can sometimes suppress your immune system, which may sound counterintuitive, while also trying to target what we think will be detrimental to the virus.
We have an email here. Bill from Green Lake emailed to ask, what does Wisconsin's curve look like now, and how is it flattening, and what do you see there?
You know, that's a great question. I will say that we are seeing the effects in our hospitals in Wisconsin of the early stay-at-home orders by the governor. This is different than other states, and it has a lot to do with population density, Milwaukee being an exception. And as we expand out this stay-at-home order with the schools closed, business closed, we expect to see smaller numbers and really fewer deaths than our neighboring states. And I think our Midwest colleagues, Minnesota, Illinois, have kind of come together to understand what the importance of the social distancing is. And as we've seen in the media, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of frustration. You know, small business owners want to open up. People want to get out of their houses and you know, enjoy the weather and be liberated from really this time out in our human life here. But really, this is not the time. And there's a specific route that the government, the U.S. government, has set forward to reopen states. And our local government, our state government, is following that to a T. And I really think we are seeing vastly decreased numbers. We are flattening the curve compared to other states. It's really impressive.
The CDC came out with these new symptoms, additional symptoms this week, the 6 new symptoms. What do you see there? Are there newer symptoms arising in patients, or is this just expanding out what doctors have seen previously?
That's a great question. So those principal symptoms up front, 73% having a fever, 2/3 having muscle cramps, and then, 15 to 20% having this loss of smell. I would caution people to use that spectrum of symptoms that they come up with as a screening mechanism, and really look towards those big three: the fever, muscle cramps, shortness of breath. Now, the interesting thing with that loss of taste and smell.
And I want to pause right there with loss of taste and smell, because I want to get into that with Dr. Joe Padaruca, who stays with us. He chairs the ICU unit at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Taking your questions, we'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC this week added 6 symptoms to its novel coronavirus list. We're talking about it with pediatric cardiologist Joe Padaruca, who chairs the ICU unit at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also a principal investigator for the Convalescent Plasma Expanded Access Program at Mayo Clinic in southwest Wisconsin. Dr. Padaruca, as you were talking there about losing the taste and smell, a little bit more on that particular symptom?
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that kind of a curious symptom to have?
Yeah.
It calls to mind one of the unique and vastly important differences in SARS-CoV-2 compared to SARS-2003. Patients with COVID-19, their peak shedding is 24 hours prior to them developing pure symptoms. And there's some anecdotal evidence that this loss of taste and smell may be one of the early symptoms that may be preceding the onset of these significant symptoms, fever, muscle cramps. So, in fact, maybe that might be one of the early symptoms, even the more asymptomatic patients. So they're looking at that more, but it is a very curious symptom and one that should call to mind patients to possibly be assessed and tested.
Let's bring in a call now. Rita is with us from Green Bay. Hi, Rita.
Good morning. I want to thank you, Doctor, for all your hard work. I know it's always challenging in these new situations to, the whole world is a spectrum of where do we begin. I'm wondering about the challenges of the people who come in with these heavy symptoms and the number of challenges you face because these people are coming in with multiple issues already going on in their body, blood pressure issues, heart, stroke, diabetes. It's one thing for a person who's struck with an illness and they have no underlying illnesses, but how much more challenging are you finding it when you're dealing with glucose sugars in the bodies or maybe leg issues with someone?
Some pre-existing conditions. Thank you so much, Rita.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And the majority of patients that we're seeing that are having the COVID-19 positivity do have chronic disease, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes. Some are on immunosuppressive medications for various things. These patients are at risk. So when we're trying to manage these patients, the second hit of a novel destructive virus in the background of an already chronic illness makes the burden of treatment that much more difficult and the burden of recovery that much more challenging for the patient. So we're faced with not only treating the virus, but also treating those other illnesses that may be even precipitated to decline by the coronavirus itself. We know that it can lead to multi-organ failure, cause strokes, clots in the lungs, the legs, body, can lead to other issues with the gut, kidney failure, heart failure. We're seeing some cases of a myocarditis. This is not a virus that a person that's susceptible is going to handle easily and will need expert medical care to move ahead.
Rita, thank you. Let's bring in Dwayne now in Weston with a question. Hi, Dwayne.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, Joe. Did you hear of the research study from China early on about the type O blood? They said they studied the blood types and less people with type O were getting less severe symptoms or maybe even not getting it at all, even if they were exposed to it. And do you think that's why there's such a range of severe symptoms of some people not getting it, not feeling fine? I mean, are all coronaviruses can have that range of, like if you get type A influenza, is everybody getting really sick or some are no symptoms at all? Why is this one where there's some no symptoms and some are dying?
Yeah, Dwayne, great question. And what does blood type have to do with it, if anything?
Yeah, certain populations across the world are predisposed to different blood types. We know that some patients maybe have an easier time with recovering from challenging illnesses. We haven't seen that pave out in the literature looking at specific blood types as a protective factor for COVID-19. But I think there needs to be more research ahead on that.
It seems like there is so much different research going on all at the same time. Another area that we've been seeing is CPAP machines emerging more frequently now, a device that had been used for sleep apnea patients. How might these machines be used?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if someone's in respiratory distress and their oxygen levels are low, that machine is really better than using simple oxygen by a mask or nasal cannula. It provides a little bit of pressure support. However, this should not be used as a bridging to avoid going to the hospital. There's also the side effect that it can be sort of an aerosol-generating procedure, if you will, meaning that it can generate these tiny little virus droplet particles that could be very easily transmissible and can be projected greater than 2 meters away from a patient and possibly infecting someone else. Remember, for every one patient that has coronavirus, 5 to 7 people that they know or come in contact with will become infected. So it's just important that we don't use that as a crutch to delay hospital care and understand that that does put patients and families and the community at risk to use that routinely.
Let's bring in Mark now in Kimberly with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I think there's need for more transparency from hospitals to know what your local hospital is doing with the convalescent patient plasma. You know, you say you're part of the expanded use program or effort.
Yeah, and Mark, I want to, let's pause right there and get more information on the convalescent plasma program and how that is working at your hospital.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So the plasma is used for really the sickest of the sick. We're talking about patients in the ICU on the ventilator that has specific findings, including multi-organ failure. It's a precious, limited resource. Fortunately, as more people recover, we're going to get a greater pool for that resource. And, you know, I'd really encourage, at least here in Wisconsin, if you have had a positive test, if you have recovered, that you go and donate your plasma. Versiti is our blood bank for Wisconsin. They have different sites, including in your local community. And it would just take a simple phone call, patient instigated, to become a donor.
How effective are these transfusions for patients who need this plasma? Do we know the effectiveness?
You know, we have those small case series from SARS 2003, which showed some benefit. Earlier time to recovery, et cetera, was not really trialed to show a mortality benefit. But when you think about the physiology of this, this is a robust medical, novel, cutting-edge therapy. You're taking recovered antibody from another human being in a novel virus that hasn't been seen before and giving it to another person. You're giving them a fresh immune system. In the absence of really reliable drugs up until remdesivir, as we understood yesterday, this would be an exciting intervention.
In the last moments we have with you, what do you want us to understand about the pandemic from the healthcare team perspective and about how you're operating in your hospital?
Yeah, so I know those in the community and in Wisconsin, it's frustrating times not to go to the stores and the restaurants and being stuck in your house. But really, you're keeping patients safe. You're keeping the community safe. You're protecting us, the frontline healthcare workers, including nursing, respiratory therapists, lobotomists, et cetera. We are in a pandemic. These are scary times. Look for the helpers. We are the helpers. We are ready. We want to serve. We want to do our duty. And we are the people that want to run into the fire and take this head on. So while it's frustrating, the setback, the comeback will be better than the setback. So just keep that in mind as we look ahead. And, we're really honored to serve patients in these scary times.
Dr. Paderewka, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Dr. Joseph Paderewka chairs the ICU and pediatrics departments at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also the principal investigator for the Mayo's convalescent plasma program in Southwest Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up next hour, caller only, getting your ideas for segments in the future. 800-642-1234. Back after this news update on the Ideas Network.